Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Deputy Editor Lee Boyce is Assistant Editor Helen Crane. And coming up, awful April, appalling April, atrocious April. There's a lot of bad this month happening to our personal finances, but actually there's a sprinkling of good news. We run through some of the changes. Also today, renting set to become cheaper than buying for the first time in 14 years, a sign of a pending recession, plus the plight of the high-earning mortgage prisoners, and the simple energy gadgets that you can buy that could wipe out the hike. Don't forget, you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
eToro is a social network.
No, eToro is an investment platform. Fly me to
the moon. It's both. That's social investing. In other words, it's where millions of people invest in stocks, share ideas, strategies, and beyond. eToro, the power of social investing. In other words, download eToro today from the App Store or Google Play. Your capital is at risk.
But first, this is one heck of a month for our personal finances. Energy bills, national insurance, council tax, mobile broadband, the list of rises goes on. But there are other big changes happening too, some not so terrible. A significant one for those planning on getting divorced, for example, is in there. So let's run through some of them. Firstly, Helen, is awful April really so awful?
Yeah, it is pretty bad, unfortunately, for a lot of people. With the new tax year, we've got a whole host of things going up. National insurance is one of the big ones that's going up by 1.25%. Dividend tax also for investors going up by 1.25%. We've got the rise in the state pension, 3.1%, which sounds okay, but when you consider that CPI inflation is currently 6.2%, that's not ideal. And that's on top of all the other cost of living stuff. So obviously the Ofgem energy price cap has just gone up as well. So April is shaping up to be pretty awful for a lot of people.
Yeah, pretty miserable. Let's pull out some of those, shall we, Lee? Some of those changes. Obvious starter for 10, as Helen mentioned there first. I mean, I think we've done the energy price cap rise to death. We can leave that, I think, to one side. But we're going to look at perhaps more depth about some other issues. And one of those, as Helen said, was the national insurance rates going up and dividend tax hikes. Now, national insurance is a little bit confusing. I was in a coffee shop today as the guys, the baristas behind the bar, as it were talking about how they've just noticed in their pay packet that they're going to have less money, etc. And I wanted to jump in and say, yeah, but there's going to be changes happening in July. And I thought, no, Georgie, shut up and just take your coffee. Lee, confusing.
Yeah, it's really confusing. We won't really recover too much old ground because you heard Simon and I talking about this and you a couple of weeks ago where we sort of said, hold on, this tax is going up and then it's going down. In a couple of months' time. So, I'll quickly just to recap. April is looking really bad for most people, right? You can't club everyone together, as I always say on this podcast. There's people that are going to struggle immensely. There's people that are going to struggle. And then there's some people that actually are going to ride it out and I'm sure will be absolutely fine. But there are a handful of things that have happened this week and specifically with the new tax year. So national insurance, as you say, start for 10. That is the most sort of talked about one, I would say, in the last few months. I mean, it has been an absolute personal finance hot topic. It's been a political hot topic. You know, it breaks the Prime Minister's manifesto pledge not to tinker with national insurance.
Does a threshold rise, though, sort of counterbalance that? And of course, this is just going to be part of a health and social care levy, so a new tax. So technically, it's only sort of a 3-month blip of a manifesto break.
Yeah, do you know what? I've gone away and I've kind of digested all this a little bit more and had a think about it. You know, we, in the aftermath of the budget, sometimes it's kind of so frantic, so frenzied, there's so much going on. You know, you do need to take a little bit of time just to sort of like, you know, decompress. You know, those dark nights where you wake up in the middle of the night and you start thinking about national insurance. You're totally right. I mean, that change in the budget was pretty massive. And you could argue appeased some people that were calling for the hike to be spiked completely, right? So that is, you know, the confusing bit is, as you say, as we were saying in the podcast of the week, average person on the street is confused as to why national insurance is rising 1.25 percentage points now and then it changes in July because of the bigger threshold that's coming in. You know, that is quite confusing, I think, on the street. But the upshot of it is for lower earners, it's actually, you know, take home pay, it should be better. Your NI contributions are actually going to drop. So I've got a couple of examples here, just sort of like rough examples to give you a kind of idea. So if you're earning £20,000, you would have been paying £104.32 national insurance a month. That's going up to £111.74. However, from July, that will go down to £82.04. Mm. I mean, that's quite a sizable difference. And then at 30k, it was £204.25. You'll now be paying £222.15 until July. That's going to drop to £192.46. Now that goes all the way up to £50,000 pay bracket, where you would have been paying £404.32 in national insurance. That's going up to £442.99. So that's quite a bit. And then from July, that will be £413.29. So a little bit more than what it has been, but nowhere near what it is from now to July. So that's the confusing bit for people. So essentially, if you're earning roughly about £50,000 and above, you're going to be paying more in national insurance. If you're earning under that, you're not. And you could argue, Georgie, and this is what I've gone away and had to think about. I think in this country, you know, we've much talked about the social care problem that we have and the funding gap that we have. And I think the majority, you know, a large chunk of people are happy to pay a bit of extra tax if it's getting ring fenced and going into social care. And we can see a tangible difference of what that money is doing. And they're happy to do it. But it's been done in such a haphazard way.
Yeah. Also, timing is terrible. We are in the grips of a terrible cost of living crisis. Just bear with me on this one, Lee. Look, I understand that as a result of the changes, that what they said was going to be 12 billion extra in this 1.25% hike is now going to be 6 billion. Now, bearing in mind that they're going to cream that off and have it as a health and social care levy from 2023, okay, great. And they're going to reduce national insurance rates back down to the level they are, or they were a couple of days ago, right? So my question to you is, if our national insurance contributions are what pay for things like benefits and state pensions, etc., isn't there going to be a big shortfall?
Well, Georgia, this is the kind of wonderful fag packet maths that a lot of people...
I.e., will the Chancellor keep it, the rates high, is what I'm asking, from April, and still have a health and social care levy separately? Or is that a bit ballsy?
That's a tricky one.
Helen, what do you reckon? Where's your money?
Yeah, it's
in the Chancellor's coffers. That's where.
Yeah, it's a really tricky one, isn't it? I mean, if people get used to paying that higher rate of tax, I mean, you would, you know, you could see him kind of keeping it that way. But I don't know. Things are changing so quickly at the minute, aren't they? It's really difficult to know.
There was quite an interesting story this week from the paper about quite like this payslip propaganda. So basically, the HMRC asked businesses to put a little note on payslips saying what the rise, this 1.25 percentage point rise, was for. And I just thought that was just a funny little detail that basically the government...
Straight out of the books of behavioural economics, yeah, the nudge department,
like,
yeah?
Know, it's really the government. It's up to the government to sort of like spread the message about what this money is meant to be ring fenced for. And I just thought it was a funny little bit. But yeah, the dividend tax hike, again, there's another hike of 1.25 percentage points. That's going to boost the Treasury by, well, estimates, 1.3 billion. It could be even a little bit more than that. It means that for a basic rate taxpayer, 8.75%. For higher rate taxpayer, be 33.75%, and for additional taxpayers, 39.35%. Basically, the dividend tax is if you receive dividends from a company, you pay tax on it. And a lot of people do invest in that way and have diligently.
What if you're a self-employed person as well?
I mean, exactly, yeah. And if you're paying dividends out of the business, you know, it's a pretty big deal to people. And that was actually, that allowance was slashed in 2018 from £5,000 to £2,000, so it got less generous anyway. And the government's estimates are saying that 40% of people with dividend income outside of an ISA will see a tax increase, and 70% of that will be paid by higher and additional rate taxpayers. So effectively, what they're saying there is a lot of people are kind of doing this through their ISAs anyway, which has got a fairly generous tax wrapper of £20,000. Some people, lucky people, we'll talk about in a sec, potentially maxing that out. And then we've just had a new tax year in which another allowance has come in. So, you know, might have dodged it in that way. And you could argue, and I'm sure there are people that will argue, that this is kind of a rich person problem, right? But at the end of the day, I kind of understand that logic. But there's a lot of people out there that have, you know, built up wealth the right way and invested in the right way. And we'll see this as just another tax grab, basically, on you know, middle to higher earners. It's just tax,
isn't it? Just tax. Yeah, but Rishi's a chancellor of low tax, remember, Lee? That was what the whole spring statement was about, wasn't it? Helen, you mentioned there about the state pension rise going up 3.1%, I believe. You know, when you take into consideration inflation, it doesn't really compare, does it? But saying that, I mean, we had lots of people calling for it to be raised. It looks likely that September's inflation figure might be quite significant, and the government will find themselves in another little bind. Will we have a single lock?
Yeah, and under the previous system was a triple lock, which meant that the state pension would increase every year by either price inflation, earnings growth, or 2.5%. So the earnings element was scrapped from this year's rise because during COVID, wages were sort of distorted and they went up by about 8%. So that was scrapped. They put it up by the higher of price inflation or 2.5%. So that was 3.1% it went up with this time. But yeah, if inflation by September is around 8%, it would be difficult to see the government putting up pensions by that much. So yeah, we may be stuck with a 2.5% rise, which in the scheme of, you know, all the other huge cost of living increases would be really difficult for a lot of pensioners.
I think it's been deeply unfair, that 3.1% rise. And I remember saying at the time, I remember we had a good podcast on it, a good chat about this, and I argued at the time that 5% would have been a much fairer solution, you know, halfway house between 3.1% that was, you know, now kicked in, or 8% wage growth, which felt quite high. It was like a middle ground, almost like a solution in the middle. And, you know, as a result of that, now state pension has gone up this week by 3.1%. Inflation is running away. Energy bills, there's plenty of pensioners that are going to be struggling out there to make ends meet. Mm. And we've just gone through this really quite mean looking state pension. So the full flat rate will rise by £5.55 a week. It's just not going to go very far. But it's a balancing act, isn't it? As we always say, you know, it's difficult to give massive, you know, almost double digit state pension increases when so much has gone on, when the national debt has increased so much. But at the same time, you know, workers have paid into their NIs all their life and, you know, all their working life, and want to reap the rewards of, you know, what should be a state pension that helps, you know, you're either relying on it or supplementing your income with it. The thing is now, the government has got a massive headache coming down the line. I mean, it's huge. The inflation, we're talking 8%, could be 9%. It could be double digit by the end of the year, Georgie. It really could be. What are they going to do then? I mean, yeah, it's going to be uproar if they do it for a second year in a row, I would argue. It's stuck between a rock and a hard place. Maybe my magical 5% again, yeah, might be the solution. But yeah, it's
I don't know what they're going to do. They must be thinking
about it.
It's
a difficult balancing act. It's really difficult. It is. I mean, I sometimes used to think, oh, being Chancellor would be a bit of fun. You know, I used to see George, you know, kind of go up there with all his gusto, and I think, oh, this looks like a good job. Now I'm like, well, this would possibly be one of the worst jobs on planet Earth. Yeah. I mean, I just don't know, yeah, what they're going to do. But that is something that is just another thing that is along the pipeline of a list of other massive things to do with our finances.
Yeah, I was just about to ask the tax status of your wife, Lee, but thought that probably wasn't appropriate. Although we are going to talk about, in our whistle stop tour of April, one big change that I think can be called quite a positive, certainly would be, I think, by people who've gone through divorce and divorce solicitors, although they might not like it so much in the fact that they could probably get more money from arguing couples and bitter wranglings. But the no-fault divorce changes came in, Lee. Happily married Lee. But if you weren't happily married, this would be better, wouldn't it?
Well, this is a massive shake-up, Georgie. This is the biggest shake-up to divorce in 50 years. And it's bringing divorces, really, dragging them into the 21st century, you know, which basically is a much-needed move. And the reason why I've included this into the things to know for this new tax year is because, as you say, these rules came in this week. Mm. And I sort of word ear to the ground type stuff is that a lot of people have been holding off getting divorced, waiting for these new rules to come in. Because it's going to be low cost.
Explain what they are. What was the system before, this weird system where you had to like blame someone?
Exactly. Well, there's always that. There always has to be a reason for divorce, and you might have someone, one half might be opposed to getting divorced, and it could get completely messy, and there'd be a lot of wrangling between solicitors. You know, that won't be the case anymore. So couples will be able to get divorced within 6 months of first applying, even if one partner is opposed. And the process will be largely online, which, you know, again, you imagine all the paperwork that gets involved in all this. And in a lot of parts of our life where paperwork is still king in a world in which we are more and more digitalized, you know, think of things like property, like house deeds and all that kind of stuff gets stored in a vault somewhere. You know, it's all mad stuff. Like, you know, a lot of things we've just kind of taken our time to get and make online. And divorce is definitely one of those. And basically, you can serve divorce papers by email. And all of this should bring down the cost substantially. Financial settlements will still be dealt with in a separate parallel process. I almost said a parallel universe there, but a parallel process, which could continue after the divorce is final. So the reason why I'm mentioning this in this financial roundup is, first of all, you should be able to get divorced without breaking the bank, for one. But if you've got pensions, property, significant savings, investments, you know, it is still worth getting help from professionals. And the reason why I mention all of that is because of this haste, because of this speed, it could result in financial mistakes, you know, because if you're trying to wrap this up really quickly and it's quite complex and there's money and, you know, property and investments and pensions and one partner's trying to hide, you know, one half is trying to hide some of this wealth and all of that kind of thing. There is that argument that going too quickly could just result in mistakes happening. So, you know, in one way, it should bring the cost down. And if it's a simple divorce where there's not many assets, it all should be a pretty smooth sailing process. But this isn't the, you know, answer for these messy, complicated divorces, some of which, you know, sometimes we see played out in the media if it's famous people, for example. You know, there is just assets absolutely everywhere. It's still a complicated process to do all of that up and you know, make the right calls and the right choices.
Just means you don't have to make it, hopefully, any more bitter than it really needs to be. But Helen, you know, marry in haste, repent in haste as well, I guess. What about the sanctity of marriage, though?
Yeah, I mean, that's sure, the sanctity of marriage, but that's not, it doesn't necessarily need to be kind of enshrined in law, does it? I think this is a good move for a lot of people. I know a few people who've kind of, you know, married in their 20s, sadly getting divorced in their sort of early mid-30s, and wow. this would have made their life so much easier, because, you know, they have maybe a flat that they're happy to kind of split the difference on, don't have any kids, not really any assets, and they still have to, either one of them has to blame the other, or they have to prove they've separated for 2 years. And I think, you know, this for them would make their lives so much easier, so much cheaper. I think it's a bit of a no-brainer, really.
All right, well, back in the day, renting used to be the cheaper option while you'd save up for a house deposit. However, for the last 14 years, that has not been the case. But now, renting looks set to become cheaper than getting a mortgage, which could signal trouble ahead, according to new research, because the last time the average monthly cost of a mortgage exceeded the price of rent was between 2004 and 2008, and in the late 1970s and 80s, shortly before, of course, recessions hit. Is history about to repeat itself. Before that, a potted housing history over the last decade or so. Helen, how are we where we are? I appreciate that's a long question.
Quite a big ask. A lot's happened in the last decade, but broadly, so we're talking sort of since the financial crisis around sort of 2008. Basically, the last time mortgages were more expensive than renting was around then. So started in about 2004 and kind of ran till about 2008. Since 2008, renting has been the more expensive option. So mortgage payments kind of took quite a big dip as we recovered from crash. Banks mainly sort of didn't need to shore themselves up by charging these kind of higher mortgage rates. So for the last sort of decade or so, buying has been the best option. But it does look like now, with house prices having gone up, the size of mortgages going up and mortgage rates going up, that owning on a monthly sort of payment basis is going to overtake renting for the first time in 14 years.
Lee, surely that's good news, isn't it? Isn't it?
Well, it depends. These are really interesting figures from Capital Economics, and it's based on a monthly repayment on a 20% deposit mortgage. And they say that currently is £870, but that's going to go beyond £1,000. Right, by the start of 2023, we have been in an era of rock bottom mortgage rates, to the point where last summer we were seeing rates consistently below 1%. I mean, that is criminally cheap. That is crazy. That is just the cheapest mortgages you will probably ever see ever again. I reckon it'd be very doubtful that we'll get below that. But we've seen mortgage rates go up in recent months because of 3 base rate rises. There may be some more on the cards between now and the end of the year. And for that reason, people are going to find mortgages more expensive, whether they're on a variable rate or whether they're coming to the end of a fix and they're having to take another fix out. So
it's not rents are coming down, it's mortgages going up. Exactly. Above rents.
They're both going up. Both forecast to go up by the start of 2023. It's just that mortgages are going to go up substantially quicker than rents. And that's what this is arguing in here. So what they're saying is that rents would increase from £935 a month. So currently more expensive than servicing a mortgage to £980 by the start of the next year. But you know, this is broad. This is an average. This is like a typical. When you think about some of the pockets of Britain that completely distort this, like London.
And I wish I was paying that.
Yeah, there's people listening to this podcast going, "Court, you know, for probably a studio flat in zone 1-3, you're talking 1,250, 1,500 quid, maybe.
Easily.
You know, it's not cheap to rent." And that's always the argument with research that we get from, you know, this is taking quite a big view of it, this Capital Economics study. But when you get the studies from, you know, building societies, banks and things, 9 times out of 10, or even more than that, like basically all the time, it will say buying is cheaper than renting, you know, and that's because mortgage rates have been so low that, you know, you could end up having cheaper monthly mortgage repayments compared to rents. But that tide looks like it may turn. But that's not to say, oh, you know, that means don't go out and buy a home if you're a first time buyer. You know, at the end of the day, you own the asset. Well, you know, you're taking out a mortgage on the asset that you will eventually hopefully pay off and own outright. Whereas if you're renting, you're just lying in a landlord's pockets. I mean, we all know that it's not a secret, but it's just interesting to think that mortgage payments are going to be getting more expensive than rents. And the reason why I say that's quite interesting is because I think we've been, take this week, right? We've had a Halifax House Price Index come out saying that house property prices have gone up £28,000 in a year. You know, that's almost the average salary in Britain. That's a lot of money. You know, your home is probably earning you a salary at the moment in the last year. They've gone up £43,000 since the start of the pandemic. That is a big chunk of change. You know, that's a massive rise. There's a lot of people that might have, and I'm going completely with a few friends and family members that I know, and I shall name no names or give no details further than that, but might have bought homes that are between that £500,000 and sort of £800,000 bracket. You know, you typically that second step up or maybe third step up the property ladder, where you're looking maybe for an extra bedroom or a utility room or a bigger garden. And they've done this, you know, because they want to move, but they want a bigger place. But also because mortgage rates have been so cheap that they might look at that and go, you know, 2-year fix at 1% or whatever it is that they've managed to get, monthly repayments don't look so bad. But it's just what happens after 2 years if that rate is, instead of being 1%, it's now 2%. And that is quite a sizable increase. And that's what I think this capital economics study is kind of getting at, is that the pending recession thing is kind of like, you could see how that could play out if you think about it. If you think about that kind of long-term outlook over sort of like the next 2 to 5 years, how many people are in that boat that perhaps have bought a home for a bit more money than they were kind of expecting in their lifetime, yeah, perhaps because of runaway house prices. But to get that next step or step up, you have to pay the money. You've got your monthly payment repayments go, well, actually, yeah, this is not too bad, this is manageable. And then it's just when a lot of people have been taking out 5-year fixes, so that might negate that problem. But even 5 years time, who knows what's going to happen with mortgage rates between now, from what we've seen rock bottom summer 2021, what's it going to look like in summer 2026? Well, could be more base rate rises in the near future this year, let alone before 2026. It's obviously a long way away, so you can't predict. But from here to 2024, that is not far away. And if we're seeing another 1, 2, 3 base rate rises before that, it could make mortgages quite a bit more expensive. So I think this is what this capital economics research is really all about. And I think that essentially this is what it's getting at about it being a precursor to recession. Mortgages are more expensive than rents at the end of the 70s, recession at the start of the 80s, same late 80s, 90s, and then just before the financial crisis. And you can see how that all unfolded. You know, we don't need history lessons on all that in regards to property. So does it mean the same again? Well, look, it's a different set of circumstances, completely different backdrop, economic backdrop of what's been going on, especially from the pandemic. You know, we've got this tragic conflict going on still, you know, in Ukraine. All these kind of things are just so turbulent for all of our finances and economics in general, and especially for what is essentially most people's biggest purchase if you own a home and you have a mortgage on it.
Well, we'll talk more about mortgage prisoners shortly after this.
Now, with a big business story of the week and one to watch next week is Ben Laidler, global market strategist at our sponsor eToro. Now, Ben, we had Elon Musk on Twitter this week. Explain what was going on there.
Yeah, anything to do with Elon Musk is always interesting, right? And this was a big one. He's taken a 9% stake in Twitter. He's now by far their biggest shareholder. And I think this is great news for Twitter, right? You've got someone with his track record and resources paying a lot of attention to this stock. So you've had a big rally in Twitter share price. It's really focused attention across the whole social media sector. So Meta, across the Snap, and he obviously knows the platform pretty well, right? He's got 80 million followers and he's posted 17,000 tweets. So, you know, he's been a busy person. It looks like he's going to get busier.
Yeah, that's right. And then next week, one to watch maybe is Tesco results.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the consumer's obviously been in the eye of the storm, right? Everyone's under pressure from rising inflation, energy prices, taxes. So it'd be really interesting to see the Tesco results. They're going to be pretty good. Earnings are probably going to double sort of year over year. But I think the real focus is going to be what they say about things going forward. You know, we had some negative results from Morrison's, fourth largest supermarket. You know, they're warning about some of the pressures they're seeing. So I think Tesco's going to be fine, right? It's a big player, a lot of economies of scale. You know, we all need to eat, but it's also the sort of global earnings season starts next week, right? So I think we're all going to be looking at earnings, not just Tesco, but around the world. And given how jittery markets are, I think these earnings are more important than ever.
Excellent. That was Ben Laidler, our sponsor, eToro.
Welcome back to part two. Now, sticking with the expensive housing theme, the pandemic boom could leave high-earning homeowners, as Lee mentioned earlier, trapped and unable to move if they overstretch themselves to buy. They may be unable to remortgage as lenders consider their squeezed incomes during the cost of living crisis. Helen, high-earning homeowners who spent too much money on homes during the pandemic always reminds me of whatever, I think it was you, Lee, wise words of Lee Boyce that says, you know, never buy peak, always buy a home that you can improve, especially if at the moment when house prices are already super high, look for something you can add value to. Did you say that, Lee, or have I just attributed that? Sounds like something you
said. It sounds like some boring mantra that I definitely would.
There we go. There we go. So either way, I think it sounds eminently sensible, Helen. What's the issue here? Are people not doing that?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those world's smallest violin stories a little bit. You know, you're looking at homeowners who perhaps had some money saved during COVID. These are reasonably high earning people and they thought, you know, mortgage rates are cheap. They obviously had the stamp duty holiday, and they thought, brilliant, I'm going to buy a bigger house than I maybe thought I could get before. I'm going to skip a step on a ladder, maybe kind of go from a flat to a four-bedroom house rather than a flat to a two-bedroom house. The issue is now, obviously, those very cheap mortgage rates they got are now going up. So if you look at, say, someone on took out a two-year fix in, I don't know, summer 2020, they're coming up to their mortgage having to be renewed pretty quickly. Rates might have gone up by, for some people, about 1%, which is a lot of money. Lenders do their affordability tests when you're applying for a mortgage, and they're now factoring in all of the cost rises that are coming with the cost of living crisis. So the sort of things we spoke about before, increased national insurance, things like dividend tax, which will impact people who own their businesses, might pay themselves in dividends. So mortgage owners are factoring all of that in, which means that with the mortgage being expensive and there being more pressure on their income, they might not qualify. So they could be turned down for a remortgage. They've kind of overstretched themselves and could potentially end up essentially being mortgage prisoners, which is something, you know, we normally sort of associate with financial crisis, people take out interest-only mortgages, but it also applies to people who, yeah, for whatever other reason, simply can't get any mortgage. And that means they'll end up on their lender's standard variable rate, which can be 4-4.5%. So paradoxically, they're saying they can't afford these lower payments, but for that reason they're put on higher rate where they'll actually have to pay more.
Is this just an issue for high earning homeowners? I mean, surely sort of middle earning, I imagine, have overstretched themselves somewhat.
Yeah, that is true. It's people in the middle as well. I think, so we had a story last week, which suggested it's particularly going to affect people who own their own businesses, run their own businesses. And this is all around this dividend tax issue. So if they, a lot of business owners will pay themselves in kind of dividends from their businesses, and that, you know, the tax on that is obviously going up quite substantially. So for those who are running, you know, paying themselves quite a big income from their business, that would really affect them. But yeah, it's homeowners of all kind of stripes, really, but particularly those who stretch themselves a bit in terms of the property that they've bought in the last couple of years.
Luke?
Yeah, I mean, it's what I was alluding to just now, Georgie, really. I mean, we're going to see lenders sort of tightening their belts a bit. You know, there's been quite a frenzied mortgage market in which, you know, lenders are quite happy to lend out, you know, at really quite cheap rates, and getting people through the door, so to speak, and to do that. And when you remortgage, typically you don't really go back through your affordability. You know, the bank usually typically just looks at, you know, have you been servicing the mortgage? But that might all change with all of these kind of pressures that are coming in. And I think Lewis Shaw of Shaw Financial Services explained this pretty well in this story. He said, with lenders now really starting to tighten their belts, we could easily see a scenario where over-leveraged borrowers with big mortgages may struggle to remortgage as lenders' affordability models are adjusted in line with tax rises and the cost of living crisis. And he actually adds, really, this could have like a trickle down effect, you know, that quite often dominoes start to fall when we're talking about properties right at the top of the market. You know, they can then have a trickle down effect further down the market in terms of potential house prices and that kind of thing. He said, business owners who pay themselves in dividends will be at particular risk being squeezed from every direction. Not only do they have to cope with the employer's national insurance increase, corporation tax hikes and higher dividend tax rates hitting their own disposable income, they also have to face down calls from staff for wage increases. It's a brutal balancing act. Small business owners in general really are facing a lot of pressure, a lot of headwinds, and a lot going on. There's all sorts of rises that are happening, and that's, you know, then has another trickle-on effect to people that buy the goods and services, and that's why we're seeing inflation sort of soaring, because costs for business owners are going up. So, you know, it's, again, it's one of those, I feel like these two stories are kind of little warning bells, almost like, you know, real sort of moments where you might look back in a couple of years and go, I remember speaking about this on the podcast, and we could kind of see how this might all play out. Mm-hmm. At the same time, if 2 years ago at the start of the pandemic you told me that house prices were going to be going up £43,000 and that we've had a red hot market and that lending has just been going through the roof, I wouldn't have believed it. So it is just impossible to predict. But I think these are two really interesting, you know, mortgage stories, property stories that are kind of little warning bells. But I'm telling you, at the moment, there is no sign of runaway house prices because of supply and demand. Simple as that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the demand is outstripping supply. I've seen a few homes go up for sale in my local area, just in this little estate that I live on, and they've sold within days. I've seen the for sale sign go up, then I've seen the sold board literally go up. Day to maybe 2 days later. There's two homes next door to each other, just a couple of rows down, and I saw both from the same estate agent, both had for sale signs in the morning when I was walking to the train station. By the time I was walking back from the train station for my commute, they both had sold signs on. That is a hot market.
Wow.
Yeah, that is a hot market.
Wow. Well, let's leave the listeners with something a little lighter, shall we? Of course, the £700 a year added to your average energy bill is no joke. But apart from turning down your thermostat by 1 degree, pulling on an extra woolly jumper, and my favourite, measuring out the exact amount of water that you would have for a cup of tea in the cup, then pouring it in the kettle, then boiling the kettle to make a cup of tea. Oof, that's effort. Is there anything simple that we can do that will make a big difference? Gadget-related tech will save the day always, won't it? What have you got for me?
Georgie, no, what you've got to be doing with the kettle...
Yeah, sorry, if I got it wrong.
Pouring in, if you're having 4 cups of coffee a day, putting in your 4 cups of water, boiling it just once, and then putting the hot water into a thermos flask, screwing it tight, and then making your cup of tea from that, so you're not boiling the kettle more than once a day.
Oh, there okay. Would a microwave be...
No. In America. No, you don't microwave tea. You don't microwave coffee. No,
that's water. But
it'd be better off just drinking tap water. No, don't do that. No, you know, at the end of the day, how much does a microwave cost to warm that up for you compared to a kettle? Don't know.
I don't know, Lee.
I don't want to find out.
Right, no. Please don't answer that question.
But, there's this story that absolutely blew up over the weekend. It just did absolutely big traffic because people are looking at ways, you know, to lower their energy bills. And some of the advice in the story, I think, is really interesting, and it might be things that people haven't considered before. And a couple of them I do have. Yeah. So first-hand experience of which I'll explain in a minute. But number one on this list is a Robo radiator valve.
This looks interesting, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a bit Terminator-esque when I read this. And you might have heard me the other week when I was saying, I'm just fed up of hearing about turning down the thermostat and you could save X amount. And that actually, when I had our boiler replaced a couple of years ago, I had all of the valves replaced on the radiator. So they're much better now. They're much more modern, have a 1 to 5, and you can go around, you know, turning it up or turning it down, depending on the room and depending how much heat it needs. And I, you know, that can help you save money. This is one step beyond this. These are 50 quid devices, so not cheap. But basically, they know if you're in the room or not. You can replace them quite easily. They do take 2 batteries. It says in here, to save £300 a year, install at least 5 of these devices. Now, that outlay, 5 would obviously be 250 quid, but you should make 50 quid back off of that using it. And then from then on, you know, it should do pretty, you know, help you save money in the long run. You can go one up and get one that's Wi-Fi activated. It can also be linked to, you know, smart hubs like Alexa, and they're more like 80 quid. But I think that's quite interesting. You know, improving your radiator valves is definitely something worth looking into. I think a lot of us have those old rusty ones that just, you can't read any numbers on it and you've got absolutely no idea. And the radiator is either too hot, it's absolutely scalding, or it's too low and you just don't know what the setting is. It's well worth getting those replaced, and it's pretty inexpensive. Number two on this list is LED bulbs. Now, they're a little bit of a bad rep, the LED bulbs. I feel like some people were kind of not very happy that you couldn't get the old style halogen ones anymore, because LED lighting is harsher, I think, is what people kind of allude to. But they use 85% less energy, and that can, you know, help again save money. So if you swapped all of the bulbs in your home, the average home has 34 traditional bulbs. If they were kept on for 4 hours a day, you might pay £340 a year. If you swap them all with LED, it'd be 54 quid. I mean, that is quite a sizable saving, to be quite fair. Eco shower head, a lot of us have, again, old-fashioned rubbish shower heads that just don't work properly. Quite an easy swap. You can save quite a bit of money just getting that one. It basically it's more efficient. Mm. You know, most of us shower every day rather than take a bath, and that saves quite a lot of water anyway. But then using a water efficient shower head uses 60% less water than the traditional one because it's aerated. So if you were taking a 4-minute shower with an eco shower head, it might save 40 quid a year. That's fairly sizable. If you've got a family of four, that might be 160 quid. That's pretty tasty. Now I'm coming on to number four here, smart thermostat. This is something I have. Again, when I had the boiler replaced, I had a Google Nest control put in place. Now, I love this. I thought this was, I almost did a column once saying this, people should be encouraged to get a smart thermostat rather than a smart meter, because they're really handy. You can control the temperature of your home if you're, you know, say it's the depths of winter and you're coming back from a long journey or whatever, I could turn the heating on from my phone, Wi-Fi connected, so it was all the right temperature when we got in. And all that kind of, it's quite helpful and it can help you save money. However, I've got beef, Georgie. Yeah. I've got beef with my smart thermostat. It's gone dumb. And I don't know how to fix it. And I can't fix it. I just don't know what I'm meant to do with it. It's lost Wi-Fi connectivity last summer. I can still use it, as in I can use it manually to turn the temperature up and down, but I can't link it to my phone. And most of the smart features are just redundant without being able to get Wi-Fi connected. I had I had an engineer look at it. He couldn't figure it out. I've gone through all the troubleshooting.
Can't they replace it?
And I can't figure it out. But the question is, who replaces it? Because even though it, you know, it's Nest product, they don't really have people that come out engineer-wise. It's mainly done by electricians to do it. So I'm going to have to pay for someone to take it out, get a new one replaced. It's hassle. It's quite a lot of hassle. You'd be surprised. Like, and I don't feel confident enough to sort of take it off the wall myself because of the wiring and get it all sorted. And I've just buried my head in the sand with it. I'm done with it. It works to a point where I can just turn it on in the home, but it's smart functionality.
That's a shame. Okay, it's a shame.
It's really sad, Georgie. I'm quite upset by it.
Yeah, Lee, I understand. I appreciate, because when you're putting these gizmos here on your website in this article, you say sort of the annual saving and the total outlay, but you have to factor in if it's broken, because I was thinking, oh, annual saving, you know, it may seem quite high. For example, your Robo radiator valves, total outlay 250, annual saving £300. You're like, okay, but that's £600 next year. And, you know, it keeps going rolling on. But with your smart thermostat, Lee, it literally is your annual saving and your total outlay, which your annual saving is lower than your total outlay. And if it breaks after a year, you're stuffed.
That's it. It didn't last long.
Yeah, really rubbish.
And I've tried absolutely everything, Georgia. I promise you.
Is it a bit of bad luck, Lee, or have you heard other people? There's now a time to call out and get Crane on the case.
I haven't dug around, but I should get in touch. I should get in touch with the company and find out what on earth it is I meant to do in this scenario.
Did you pull the big "do you know who I am" thing as well?
No, never.
All right, Lee.
Never in a million years. Please. No.
There you go. I don't know who you are. Sorry.
I think it's one of those things that a lot of people now that do get boilers replaced, you know, are tempted into getting one of these smart thermostats, you know, old analog ones. You know, at the end of the day, it's still an upgrade on the one that we had before, where you had to press those little tiny, like, you know, plastic buttons with the times on it. Do you know what I mean? With the circular kind of thing. You know, it's very outdated. You know, talking about dragging divorces into the 21st century, I mean, sometimes that heating system felt quite 1950s, the way you sort of had to tap little pegs to get it to come on at the right time. The last two things on this list, I've got a tiny bit of, I'm not sure how much this really works, but if you've got appliances plugged in to the wall and they're left turned on in the plug socket, they can sort of, like, they call them like energy vampires. They suck the energy out and still go even when they're on standby. The thing is, right, for like a television, for example, if I turn that off by the plug, if I then turn it back on the plug the next day, the time it takes to load up the television, it feels like it's taking quite a lot of energy to do that. Whereas if I just leave it on standby, it just comes on straight away. And I'm not sure they're saying here it could cost 4p a day. I mean,
You're not convinced, are you, Lee?
I'm not convinced by that. That's one I'm not convinced of. The last one I am convinced by, and
I like the look of this one.
After reading this, I've only gone out and got one on order. A tumble dryer egg.
Yeah,
now, I like the sound of it. It's going to come at the wrong time because all washing pretty much is going to be hung out, well, when it stops being freezing cold. But soon, I'm hoping warmer weather, clothes hung out till September, October time. But the rest of the time, relying on a tumble dryer. Got a young child, absolutely no way I'd give up the tumble dryer. The tumble dryer is a lifesaver. Now, if it's left on for an hour, a tumble dryer, 35p of electricity, not cheap. For a family washing four loads a week, 73 quid a year.
Mate, I've done four already today.
There we go.
That's a lot of money, that is, isn't it?
I mean,
I need an egg. I need an eco egg.
But my argument with this, and when people say, oh, you shouldn't use a tumble dryer, it's much better for your health than having clothes. If you're lucky enough to have a tumble dryer, than having clothes hanging around the house that are damp. You know, if you're in an unfortunate situation like that, where you haven't got a tumble dryer, or you haven't got space to dry clothes, it's not nice. It's not pleasant whatsoever. Anyway, this sounds really exciting. I'm really looking forward to getting my eco egg. And Toby Warne, who's written this story for The Mail on Sunday, I reckon has basically created a surge in eco egg sales from this, because it's a £10 dimple sized thing that kind of goes into your wash, and it can reduce tumble dryer time by 28% because it helps laundry move around better to dry quickly, and that could save 20 quid off of that expensive tumble dryer bill.
Is like it doubled up if you put two in it, or is that just overkill?
Oh, I don't think that'll work. If I put,
see what I mean there, though.
Just tumble dryer, nothing but eco-egg. Will it work? I think that this sounds like a good idea, because actually, when you do tumble dryer clothes, they do sometimes clag together. It's a bit wet, you know, when it comes out of the wash. If it helps separate that, it might help it dry quicker. And you know what, Georgie? For a tenner, I'm willing to give it a go.
Well, Lee, write an article about it.
I'll let you know
how
it goes.
Whole article, but you know.
No, I don't think I'll do that, Georgie, because you know, I don't need just to go fall asleep and like, you know, I think two paragraphs in this story will suffice. But I'll tell you what, in 6 months' time, when it starts getting cold enough again and I can really test out my eco egg, you're getting a full review. Okay.
Thank you, Lee. Any of these, Helen, that tickle your fancy? Anything worth it, you think?
Yeah, I'm definitely keen on an eco egg. Annoyingly, I'm a renter, so I feel like if I replace the shower head, my landlord would be like, sorry, what? That's £200, please. Some of them definitely sound like a shower. I've got the LED bulbs, and I like the sound of the robo radiator thing. That sounds very good. But to be honest, I'm largely sticking to my plug-in electric blanket throw, which I just have on all the time. It's great. It's like a blanket that you can plug in. It's not like this sort of electric blanket you can put like under your sheet. It's a blanket, which is, you know, a throw that you can plug. It's amazing. Use it all the time. That's my one energy saving tip. Heating off, plug in, throw on. £50 Argos, so worth it.
I've got images of you walking around your house with this plug-in thing, but how are you moving around if it's got to be plugged in? So sort of like a hospital IV unit kind of thing going around that. Anyway, because I like to keep you updated about the state of my house, Lee and Helen, but Lee, I think it was you on the podcast. Remember when we were having this discussion about how much I was paying in electricity and energy? And it was vastly, vastly low, Helen. Apparently I only used about £6 or something of electricity in February, or £9 or something, and pretty similar gas as well. And I contacted British Gas and I said to them, are you absolutely sure about this? You know, and they said, yes, absolutely sure. So for a few months, I've been merrily going, look at me with my super efficient heating and all that sort of jazz. Yeah, then I got a message from Glenn at Number One saying he thinks that all the boxes have been mixed up. So I have absolutely no idea how much I'm meant to be paying, but I guarantee you it's probably more than £9.50. So there we go. I need to get a robo radiator valve, and I don't think an eco egg is going to help me that much, but let's give it a whirl, shall we? That's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to link into, Lee.
Yeah, you can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can give us a tweet @thisismoney. And you can also go into the comment section of where this podcast will live and leave any comments in there.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
eToro is a social network.
No, eToro is an investment platform.
Fly me to the moon.
It's both. That's social investing. In other words, it's where millions of people invest in stocks, share ideas, strategies, and beyond. eToro, the power of social investing.
In other words,
download eToro today from the App Store or Google Play. Your capital is at risk.